And with that, shall we move into the Q&A session, Victoria?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Wendy. So thanks for all of your questions. We have plenty to go through in the last 15 minutes. Wendy is going to facilitate that. Go ahead. Thank you.
Great. And the first question is for Mark, and we got a couple of questions related to the figure you mentioned at the beginning, that low-income households spend about four times as much on energy. And there were a couple of questions on this. First, clarification, did you not mean low-income spends four times relative to income, not real energy use? And the second was wondering if you happen to know the source for that figure, since they've been looking for support on that point.
Yeah, the first one I meant four times the share of income that middle-income families do. It's a commonly used number. I can send you backup for it, or we can post it. Some of it is also a function of how you define low income. So you'll see with very poor families sometimes spending 15 to 20% of their income on home energy. If a family, is making, on fixed income and has an income of, say, $10,000, $12,000 a year, it can easily hit a number that high.
Great, thank you. The next question is for Jennifer. Do your non-investor-owned utilities invest funding, and if not, why?
Many of them do invest funding in our program. So, for example, if we have a utility that is an investor-owned gas utility and there's a coordinated either rural electric cooperative or municipal utility, they'll typically kick in funding for the electric measures that we install either on a single-family home or a multifamily home. It just depends on the service territory and their sort of individual philosophy. But I would say what we're seeing is more and more participation. The more that we reach out, the more they're seeing that their customers want those choices, and they've been really responsive because we're able to, again, leverage multiple funding sources.
Great, thank you. The next question is for DTE. And Jason, you referenced that the LSP program is grant funded. And the participant asked, what specifically does that mean, and where does the grant come from? Do non-low-income customers pay to support this program?
So there's a couple of funding sources. In Michigan, we have what's called a MEEP fund, Michigan Energy Assistance Program. It's partially funded by LIHEAP to the tune of about $50 million, and then it's partially funded by we have a surcharge that all customers in the state of Michigan contribute, and that's about another $40 million. So it's a $90 million pool within the state. So about half funded by LIHEAP and then half funded through a surcharge for all of our ratepayers.
Great. Thank you. So the next question is actually for all speakers, and so if anybody has any insights on this one, please just jump on in. And the question is, are any of the speakers aware of efforts around homeowner assistance with renewable energy, such as solar, as a follow-up to or separate from the energy efficiency and weatherization programs?
This is Jennifer. I can speak to this a little. There's an organization called Grid Alternatives nationally that's starting to really reach out to do renewable energy for low-income households, and in Colorado we have as part of our renewable portfolio standard that 5% of all solar gardens that are completed in the state have to, 5% of that load has to be directed to low-income households. So we work with developers to ensure that that happens and are actually looking at other kind of creative ways to initiate solar gardens to deliver essentially kilowatts to households in lieu of cash assistance, and that's something that's being developed currently.
Yeah,
this is Mark. We are starting to see states look at using subsidies, additional subsidies for low-income families to solar. New York, I think, just adopted a new additional tax credit for low-income. I know another state that has been looking at the data on their solar programs and finding that it's mostly going to well-off families, and they're concerned about the grid being increasingly, subsidized or operated disproportionately, the impact on low-income families. So it's now starting to be looked at because a lot of the early adopters for solar were better-off families, and so this is kind of a new development, and there's a separate approach for multifamily than single family just because of the way that their buildings are financed.
Anybody else want to chime in on that one? Okay, I'll go on to another question from Mark. In your experience, have you found that local agencies prefer the potential flexibility with utility funds or would rather have to conform to the DOE guidelines for weatherization for uniformity?
No, they prefer flexibility because the utility funds as well as the LIHEAP transfer money sometimes come with fewer rules. They can use it to fill in what the DOE money can't. They can use the LIHEAP funds and the utility funds sometimes look at health and safety measures, much more flexible than the DOE money. DOE money is a lot more rigid. And so at least from my experience, it seems like states, local agencies prefer the flexibility that comes with other funds so that they can come up with the best solution for families.
Great, thank you. So we've got another question for Jennifer. Can you offer any examples of some corporate donors referenced in the matrix in your slides? What industries have done so?
Again, because we have a lot of oil and gas producers in Colorado, that industry has really stepped up over the last decade or so to support this. But we have, kind of a broad base of banks that use some of their community reinvestment funds for our programs. Large manufacturing operations, really sort of looking to who are your corporate leaders within your community, looking at what their grant guidelines are, and we typically apply under, serving either human services needs or increasingly we're working to leverage our energy efficiency programs. So we've been a lot of the contractors that we work with will support us, or the manufacturing side, of the equipment that we're looking at. They'll give us discounts, which we can provide as in-kind support and those sorts of things.
Great, thank you. So we'll do another question for DTE. Can you provide the marketing strategies that drive participation in the programs?
The LSP program or the...
I think all of them, but if you want to talk about LSP to start with, that would be great.
Sure, yeah. We partner with a number of community agencies to enroll customers on the LSP program. Our largest partner is United Way in Southeast Michigan. Then we also use Thaw, which is a local agency, Salvation Army, and a couple others. There's a couple ways. So one, it's walk-in traffic. There's a lot of walk-in traffic. There's a lot of folks that call United Way 211 for assistance or go to Thaw for assistance. So there's a lot of walk-in traffic for folks that are perhaps qualifying for other assistance that they'll then also enroll on LSP. But we also do some outbound campaigns as well. And we'll typically target customers that fit a consumption profile that we're looking for and also fit an arrears profile that we're looking for. We're looking for this particular program, we're ideally looking for customers that have income, but lower income, obviously. And then we're also looking for customers that do have some sort of payment history. So folks that want to make payments and they want to contribute toward their energy bill, but they just don't quite have the funds to do so. So folks that just, quite frankly, aren't making payments probably aren't an ideal candidate. So we'll go after customers that do meet a specific profile for us.
And for the EEA program, we have limited funding, so our marketing is really limited. So, we really use our partnering agencies. and we'll give them an allocation of what, who, how many customers they can serve, and we'll provide them with co-branded materials that they can give out to the customers. So that's one way. We also go to a lot of community events, like customer assistance days that DTE may have. We'll find a low-income population that's there, and we'll get a lot of good leads from that. We do some cross-promoting as well. So like with the lighting distribution program that I talked about earlier, on that box of LEDs, we'll do some promotions with of our other programs, like our refrigerator replacement program. We definitely use that as well, and we get a lot of feedback from that. But for the most part, like I said, our marketing is pretty limited. If the agencies may need, you know, like I said, if they need help marketing their programs, we'll give them co-branded materials. But that's about it.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to do another question for all speakers. In the small multifamily sector, is anyone aware of programs that allow landlords to access utility or state energy efficiency subsidies in cases where their low-income tenants do not want to submit documentation to qualify for WAP? So again, that's a question for all speakers. So if anybody has any thoughts on that, programs that allow landlords to access utility or state subsidies in cases where low-income tenants don't want to submit the documentation to qualify for the WAP?
I can speak to this. This is Jennifer. So the way that DOE defines multifamily is 5 units or more. And so if there's a building, as long as we have verification of income, so typically we work with a housing authority or there's a HUD-funded program, or in the case of a private landlord, we do have to get income information from each client, but they don't have to individually fill out a weatherization application. We do that centrally through the building owner. Then the entire building can be served. The rules are that 66% of a building has to have income-eligible households in order to be served with state weatherization funds. On the utility side, we're able to go to a higher income threshold. In Colorado, that's up to 80% of average median income. And so, yes, those smaller multifamily buildings can access the program, and we administer that for the utility companies.
And so with EEA as well, we also work with affordable housing organizations that have income-qualified tenants as well. Just like Jennifer.
Any last thoughts on this one? Okay, I'll do another one for the group, and maybe everyone can weigh in on this one. How important in your mind is it that there be a single point of information and distribution for energy efficiency programs?
I don't think it has to be a single point of, this is Mark, I don't think it has to be a single point of contact, but it does make a big difference. So I think it's incredibly important. It just makes it a lot easier for the family.
And
as well for traders. Oh.
And also with the EEA and LSP collaboration, we found it to be pretty a great collaboration, because with LSP they have customer advocates that a customer is assigned to, so they have that relationship. And the fact that we now have this referral tool that empowers the customer advocate to, when the customer calls them, because they're the trusted source, they call them, they're able to communicate back with updates. And so they have that one contact that they can know they can come back to and get updates. So it's been great.
Yeah, this is Jennifer. I would agree. I mean, I think to make it as easy for the client. You know, the system of how people access help has gotten very complicated, and people do have to fill out multiple applications and go to different locations, and it just discourages participation. And I think to the extent that we can really try to serve these households' needs and get them to self-sufficiency in an integrated, holistic, seamless way is the goal.
Great, and I think we're right at 3:30, and I feel like that's a good question to end on. Victoria, shall we wrap things up?
Yes, and I was going to say that that is a great statement to end the webcast on, Jennifer. Thanks. Thanks to Mark, Jennifer again, Sharon, and Jason for speaking today, and Jacob. And thanks for all of you for attending. We really hope that you benefited from it and learned a little bit about how to leverage and align EE programs for low-income households. We are going to be having two more webcasts, as I mentioned, so stay tuned to our website for information on that. If you want to get the immediate notice when it comes out, we highly encourage you to join our newsletters, which you can go to the Maine State and Local Climate website to find out how to do that. Also, as a participant, you will receive an email letting you know when the proceedings are available online. That should be in a week or two. So you'll be able to download the presentations and also listen to the audio recording. So thank you. When you log off, you will see a list of exit questions, just evaluating how we did today. We hope that you will participate in that to give us some feedback. And thanks again, and everyone enjoy the rest of your day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.